Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. It'll stay partly cloudy through the rest of this afternoon around the valley, may reach a high temperature of 106, and then for tonight, slight chance for rain, blowing dust is a possibility. We expect lows to be in the mid-80s. And then for tomorrow, partly cloudy skies, an expected high of 107, again a chance for some afternoon showers. Currently with relative humidity at 26%, it's mostly sunny and 100 degrees at KJZZ. The show will go on. Following a last-minute push, the Arizona Theater Company has met its $2 million fundraising goal to continue with its 2016-2017 season. ATC Artistic Director David Ira Goldstein says they're excited to be able to start their 50th season, but he says they need to make sure to keep future fundraising priorities in order.
The important thing is we have to keep our foot on the gas and continue to raise money. We are a nonprofit. We take in 70% of our money at the box office through earned income, but we do need to raise 30% of our budget every year to provide the services we do.
The theater company says it received more than 750 donations from individuals in Phoenix and Tucson. As you may have heard, the first day of the Republican National Convention began today, and KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block is in Cleveland with the Arizona delegates and joins us on the line. Jude, I understand day one of the convention started a little extra early for you and the Arizona delegates?
That's right. We're all staying in the same hotel in Cleveland, and at about 3:30 a.m., a very loud fire alarm woke us all up, and we had to go downstairs, many of us in our pajamas, try to figure out what was going on. Luckily, nothing serious, and we were cleared to go back to bed, but it's left a lot of us pretty groggy.
So no political dirty tricks suspected there.
Well, I refrained from tweeting too many photos of high-powered state Republicans in their pajamas, so I thought that was the respectful thing to do.
Thank goodness for that. So, Jude, remind us of some of those delegates. Who are some of the high-profile people representing Arizona?
So there are 58 Arizona delegates plus alternates, and it's a mix of elected people very involved in the party, and regular folks who are getting involved for the first time. There are several state legislators. Sheriff Joe Arpaio is here, of course. Governor Jan Brewer is an alternate. But there's also a delegate who I met who's a brand new American citizen. He's a Bulgarian immigrant who's going to be voting at the convention, but also casting his very first ballot as an American this November.
Wow. But some of the delegates are people who have been to a lot of these conventions. Who stands out for you there?
Yeah, I've talked to some people who say this is their third, fourth, fifth convention. Now, I was talking with Bob Corbin. He's an alternate. He's a former NRA president and a former Arizona attorney general. And on the first day, on the weekend when we all gathered, he was wearing this turquoise bolo tie that said AZ on it. And he said it was what all the delegates wore to the 1976 convention 40 years ago. Little piece of history there.
Yeah, and let's bring it back to 2016 now, Jude. One theme in the campaign season, there was this strong Never Trump movement trying to ensure that Donald Trump would not actually be the Republican nominee. And last week we reported that Lori Hack, an Arizona delegate, had vowed to buck the state rule and vote against Trump. That led to her being kicked off the delegation as a result. Now, she promised to show up in Cleveland anyway. What's the latest on that story?
So the state party had said that her credential was being reassigned and that she was off the delegation. Now, the Arizona Republic is reporting that Lori Hack did come to the Cleveland hotel this morning trying to get her credential and was unsuccessful. I have to tell you, I missed that scene in the lobby this morning, but that's their reporting. I think there's a sense here that the Never Trump movement is over. And a lot of the Arizona delegates who were initially backing Cruz in the primary, and that's actually the majority of our delegation were in the Cruz camp, a lot of them are telling me, look, it's not our first choice, but we want to see a Republican in the White House, so we're getting on board.
And Jude, finally, what's on the schedule today for the Arizona delegates?
So they had breakfast this morning with Governor Ducey, whose message was, yes, this was a contested primary, but the choice in the general election is simple. We need to elect Donald Trump and have a Republican back in the White House. And right now the delegates are on the convention floor. We just heard from Arizona State Senator Kimberly Yee. She addressed the entire convention. She's the only Arizona elected official who's on the speaker list at this point. She talked about her own experience as a Chinese American immigrant, achieving the American dream, why she believes in conservative values. Later today, there's going to be more speakers on immigration and border issues, which promises to be of interest to our Arizona audience.
KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block reporting from Cleveland from the Republican National Convention. And Jude, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
And that was Jude Joffe Block. Things are continuing to evolve among the delegates, and we'll keep you up to date on all of that. Our conversation with Jude was recorded a bit earlier today. Arizona's two U.S. senators are notable by their absences at this week's Republican National Convention, but the state is well represented by a contingent led by its current and former GOP governors. As KJZZ's Phil Latzman reports, they have mixed feelings about their support for the soon-to-be nominee, Donald Trump.
Doug Ducey and his predecessors all believe that Trump's inability to stay on message could be to his benefit as he tries to unite the party around him. Jan Brewer, Arizona's governor from 2009 to 2015, has been one of his strongest advocates and says she can understand his off-the-script approach.
You almost forget that you're running for president or governor or any political office because you get caught up in that moment, and it never sounds as harsh when you're in that environment as it does when it's replayed, if you will, on TV.
Fife Symington was Arizona's governor from 1991 until a conviction, later overturned, on extortion and bank fraud forced his resignation in 1997. He believes Trump's celebrity notoriety has helped voters reconcile his off-the-cuff approach.
It's like they forgive him for it, you know what I mean, or they expect it. And so it's not a shocker. So that when the media jumps on his comments about Saddam Hussein, it's like water off a duck's back with the public because there's something about Trump that it doesn't stick to him, and they understand that it's almost sort of a verbally playful side of him.
And current Governor Ducey says he's also comfortable with Trump's style, but he hopes Trump's message can be more directed to the specific issue of federal dysfunction.
These are the things that are up to him. I mean, you're in front of the microphone, you get to talk about what you want to talk about. I do think you would unify a lot of people if you pointed out Washington, D.C. doesn't work. It tries to do too many things. It does most of them poorly.
But Brewer tells Capital Media Services it's time for the candidate to get focused.
He's won the nomination. He will be our nominee. And now he needs to be all about policy. He needs to talk about the things that people are concerned about and in detail. And I think that we have seen that now come forth, and I think we will see and continue to see more of it.
And she says Trump has some work to do on social issues and should shore up his commitment to pro-life after previous pronouncements as a supporter of abortion rights. As for getting the Republican establishment to embrace him, Symington has this advice.
I would have three or four key things that are very important to the hearts and minds of Republicans of all persuasion, and just try to, you know, lay it out. This is what a vote for me would mean, and a vote for Hillary would mean, and you have a very important choice to make here.
And Ducey, who is leading the Arizona delegation this week in Cleveland, feels Trump would be wise to more specifically point out the differences between the campaigns.
This is the direction we're going. This is what I believe in, and this is what differentiates me from her, is a way to bring people together. But that requires some consistent theming and a conviction about the direction.
And for the state's current governor, there's one major issue he hopes his party's standard bearer will back off on. That's his desire to build a wall along the border with Mexico. Ducey argues his administration has worked hard to build personal and business relationships with the state's neighbor to the south. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Concern about violence between police officers and communities of color in the U.S. continues. Two rallies were held on Friday night, one in central Phoenix and the other in Tempe. Tonight, the Arizona chapter of Black Lives Matter is hosting a town hall meeting in the Valley called Moving Phoenix Forward. Reverend Reginald Walton is senior pastor of the Phillips Memorial Christian Methodist Episcopal Church. He's also chair of the Arizona Black Lives Matter campaign. Reverend, what's planned for tonight and who will be there?
We're hoping that this dialogue brings people to the table, people as diverse as Mayor Greg Stanton, Dr. Matthew Whitaker, Vice Mayor Kate Gallego.
And Reverend, will the police be taking part tonight?
Yes, sir. Assistant Chief Mike Kurtenbach is one person. I'm actually glad that he is involved. His record speaks for itself, and his leadership speaks for itself. We have a great working relationship, and so that's what we are expecting. We're looking forward to some others as well.
How much of the schedule of tonight's town hall had to do with what has happened in days recently, whether it's this weekend in Baton Rouge, whether it's in Dallas, or whether it's with citizens who were shot and killed by police officers? How much of this timing is vital, do you think?
I believe that this is very important, that we did not anticipate Sundays. We began this process actually last week, and we did not anticipate the extended tragedy that was a part of that happened in Baton Rouge. And so we will be dealing with both sides of the issue, that violence, that the actual point of this is to deal with violence and to really let people know and understand that violence is not the answer, and that we have to come together, because if we don't come together, then the situation will devolve into a perpetuation of violence.
What if the greater percentages of police officers and citizens, specifically in communities of color, are saying, yeah, absolutely, violence is not the way, peaceful protest is one path, talking to each other is one path. But what happens when there are outliers there? How much can outliers end up causing problems that people on all sides didn't anticipate?
What you will see is that outliers can cause chaos. The issue, however, is to bring as many to the table as we can, and therefore try to alleviate outliers and to bring healing as it pertains to community.
How big a problem is this in Phoenix? For people who don't know the history of things that may or may not have gone on here, when we're seeing examples of what happened in Dallas, what happened in Minneapolis, St. Paul, there's a long list, Baton Rouge, is this about grabbing the time that improvements need to happen in relations between the Phoenix PD and the community in a general sense, as they do all across the country, or are there some specific concerns about what's going on in Phoenix?
This is both national, nationwide, and locally specific. And the reason why we felt the need, a couple of years ago, there was a rash of police violence. There was a rash of shootings here in Phoenix. And so what we came together, the Phoenix Police Department and community, came together and said, listen, we need to talk about this. And so the reason why we're doing this tonight is because if we become proactive instead of becoming reactive, then that helps a lot.
How much of this is about a jumping off point and reassessing? And do you want this to be continuous? Do you want there to be more town halls, more peaceful protests? How do you want to proceed from there?
I would prefer more town halls and coming to the table, knowledgeable, open-minded, and with a matter of respect, a modicum of respect. One of the things that I've said and I will continue to say is that you can only yell for so long, because once you start yelling, people will tune you out. However, if you come and discuss things in a grown, mature manner, then you can have meaningful discussion and overcome differences.
Reverend Reginald Walton is the chair of the Arizona Black Lives Matter campaign. We've been talking about tonight's Moving Phoenix Forward Town Hall. The concept of an impenetrable border wall has been a large part of the rhetoric of Donald Trump through the 2016 primary season. But is that wall a possibility? According to a new poll released today by Cronkite News at ASU, in collaboration with Univision News and the Dallas Morning News, huge majorities of residents who live on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border don't believe it's needed. Angela Cocherga is director of the Borderlands Bureau of Cronkite News and joins me by Skype to talk more about the poll. Angela, how did the numbers come out on the border wall questions?
There were two questions in the poll. That first one asked, do you think a border wall is important? Majority said, no, it's not an important issue to us on either side of the border. And secondly, should the U.S. build a wall to secure the border? And again, the answer, the majority of people said, no, we don't want a wall. That's the very simple answer registered in the poll. we went out as reporters and journalists to dig a little deeper and kind of get to the heart of why people were saying no. And people are not saying no because they all want open borders. They just do not think that there's an existing fence now. It's doing the best job possible. They don't think an additional wall will help any more to deal with the very complex issues of immigration and drug trafficking. A lot of people stated that there's a real need to look at the root causes. Why are people sneaking across the border? They're coming for jobs. And the issue of drug trafficking, drug smuggling to meet a demand for drugs, and the issue of drug abuse and addiction is not being dealt with. So people along the border have much more nuanced and, I would say, sophisticated view of the problems.
How much of this do you think comes down to the relationship that people who live along the border on whichever side, whichever country they're in, first of all, they're on the ground. They know what's going on every day. There can be a true relationship there. This isn't someone in Washington, D.C. or someone in New York saying this. How much of a disconnect do you think there is there?
Well, we heard that repeatedly from border residents, both in the poll and then the interviews. People feel that their voices are not heard in Washington or Mexico City, because we're talking about governments on both sides and people responding to that. Again, they do feel that people come down, and as you said, we see this every political year, whether it's local, state, or of course now the presidential race, people using, in their view, kind of the border as a piñata to kind of bash and attract attention, but not to really listen to the voices of people who live there, know the region best, and who feel that they're really being left out of these important policy debates. And as you said, there is a real connection, a real close interdependence, a relationship on both sides of the border, up and down, and clearly we saw that in Arizona, where each side depends on the other.
Angela, I'm struck by the fact that it seems relatively easy for leaders on both sides of the border to talk pretty comfortably about the economic connection. Here in Arizona, we hear, certainly since Governor Ducey took over about a year and a half ago, very much talks about the importance of this economic connection between Arizona and Mexico. And yet it seems like when it comes to issues not related to the economy, the conversation may be not as comfortable. Did you find any of that with the polling or the folks you talked to on the ground?
You do see it's easy to talk about trading partners and, you know, the economic benefit of cross-border relationships. You talk about immigration, of course, it's uncomfortable, especially when people, you know, on both sides. I mean, we share more than geography along the border. There are blood ties, a lot of family ties. We talked about economic ties, but cultural ties, and those are often left out of the equation. It's often a black or white. Trade is beneficial. Everyone likes Mexico, or no, we feel afraid of Mexico because people are crossing the border. And that's not the way border residents view it. The poll had a series of descriptions. How do you see people across the border in your sister city? And there are a variety of responses that could be chosen, some not necessarily complimentary. Could be exploiters of labor, and for U.S. residents could be as criminals. But overwhelmingly on both sides of the border, all along the border, the description chosen most often was as neighbors. And neighbors who need to work together to solve mutual problems, not to be looked at as it's your problem, my problem, but to work together. That seems to be the message we're hearing.
Angela Kocherga serves as director of the Borderlands Bureau of Cronkite News and a professor of practice as well at the Cronkite School of Journalism. She's covered the Southwest border for more than 25 years. We've been talking about the new poll put together by Cronkite News, Univision, and the Dallas Morning News. And Angela, thanks so much for the time. It was great to talk with you.
Thank you, Steve.
Aerospace and aviation are part of a three-legged approach for transforming Goodyear into a hub of economic development. As Matthew Casey reports from KJZZ's West Valley Bureau, the path to the future starts with updating the Phoenix Goodyear Airport's master plan.
Joe Husband's career in airport management had an inauspicious start.
The airport business sort of gets in your blood. I actually started 26 years ago as a janitor at Sky Harbor.
Now Husband is the general manager of one of Phoenix's three airports. He works in Goodyear, a facility where planes were built for World War II.
This base, the Naval Air Facility Litchfield Park, was primarily for the manufacture and make-ready of aircraft that were going overseas to support the war effort.
The military slowly left after the Korean conflict. To help relieve traffic at Sky Harbor, the city of Phoenix bought the airport in the 1960s. Today, it's a destination for private and corporate jets, home to flight schools, and aircraft maintenance companies. With airport traffic on the rise, the Phoenix City Council recently approved spending about $600,000, most of it grant money, to update the facility's master plan. Meanwhile, the West Valley is growing again, and Goodyear wants to use about 2,500 acres of airport corridor space to help transform the city from a bedroom community into a jobs machine.
The master planning process is a valuable and exciting time for an airport because you're working on developing that roadmap for the next, 10 to 20 years of development.
An airport master plan looks at aviation and economic trends, makes sure the facility is in line with regulations, and acts kind of like a city's general plan. Airport activity is measured in takeoffs and landings. Last year, Goodyear had about 111,000 of them. That's up from when its largest flight school moved its headquarters, but down from about a decade ago when the last master plan was done. Airport planners take inventory of what's at the airport, ID any design deficiencies, analyze aviation forecasts, and use community feedback to build a layout plan. Charlie McDermott of Armstrong Consultants will be the project manager in Goodyear. He says the facility serves a different clientele.
What's unique about Goodyear is that airport is really more focused on the business aspects.
And that's no accident. Michelle Lori is Goodyear's Director of Economic Development.
The airport is a key part of Goodyear's history, but it's an even more important part of Goodyear's future.
With about 80,000 people, Goodyear is the 14th fastest growing city in the country. But most residents work outside its borders. To help change that, officials have prioritized attracting three industries: manufacturing, healthcare, and aerospace and aviation. Lockheed Martin used to have a large operation just north of the airport, but significantly downsized its presence in 2014. With the economy improving, Lori says Goodyear has become attractive to businesses again.
There are people and businesses that want to be located around the airport in our city.
Tim Berger spent the last 8 years building his family's business at the airport. A former East Coast software developer, he's the managing partner of Lux Air Jet Centers.
I'm living my dream. I get to go to the airport every day.
And Berger's dream is growing. 66,000 square feet of new hangar and office space is set to open in the fall.
Whether it's a government project or a civilian project, it's space that they can move into and do their business, which just feeds into the growth of the Goodyear Airport.
Berger lives in Gilbert, but says affordability is a big reason he chose to put his business on the other side of the valley.
Employees can come out here, work at the airport, and actually live in the community, unlike some of the other airports where maybe the ownership can live in the community, but the workers can't.
Berger says he hopes to expand again soon, and those plans would be solidified by an updated master plan that he can present to clients as a window into the future of the Phoenix Goodyear Airport.
240, Goodyear Ground.
Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Goodyear.
The U.S. government is considering removing an enormous tree that is dying in southern Arizona, and that's raised a protest from people who want the tree to die in its own time. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk, Michelle Marisco reports.
In southern Arizona, down near where glowing green cottonwood trees grow along the banks of the San Pedro River, a fight is looming between bird watchers and the federal government over the fate of one particular old cottonwood tree. This tree is known in government reports as Cottonwood W, and it's somewhere between 100 and 150 years old. Nobody knows for sure. Its deep fissured trunk is as wide as a pickup truck is long, with thick branches that swoop out into a canopy over a clearing of wild grasses and an old building made of rough timbers. Cottonwood W is a cornerstone of the San Pedro Riparian Natural Conservation, a popular place for bird watching. Renelle Stewart has volunteered at the San Pedro House.
Off and on, probably for 15 years.
And that tree, which grows just a short walk away, has been a big draw to her since she first started working here. This old cottonwood has been the centerpiece of many occasions here, a legacy, she says.
Been weddings, family reunions, birthday parties, all kind. Bilbo's birthday was celebrated using this as the big tree.
What?
Bilbo's birthday. I can't tell you much more than that.
Bird watchers like Stuart are a specific bunch. They'll correct you when you perhaps naively ask about a passing finch. That's a lesser goldfinch. And they can hear the difference between an acorn woodpecker and a red-breasted sapsucker. They like the natural, untouched feel to this preserve, its birds, and this tree. But Cottonwood W is dying, and it's near the visitor center where Stewart works, and it's enormous. So as of last winter, those parties under Cottonwood W stopped happening. The Bureau of Land Management was worried. It erected a fence around the tree, warning people to keep away.
Last 14, 15 months, branches have been falling down. And when I say branches, we mean very, very large, heavy va-voomp of a branch falling down.
Pamela Mathis is a BLM official in Tucson.
It is failing. It has fungus. It has decay. It is split around the bottom, so therefore braces would not work.
Cutting down the tree is not the final option, not yet. Some 900 people have signed a petition asking the BLM not to chop it down. Mathis worries about Cottonwood W coming down on its own, especially where there's so many people. Back at the San Pedro house, Trisha Girardet says, along with Lord of the Rings reenactments, this used to be a tree for climbing.
Oh, heck yes. I mean, isn't that what trees are for, is to climb in? So now that is closed off, and we don't mind that if they'll let it die.
That's what she and Stewart are ultimately asking the BLM to do. Prune this tree back a bit, keep the fence up, and then let Cottonwood W die on its own.
I'm reasonably certain that for the first time in my life, I will engage in civil disobedience.
Which the BLM's Mathis hopes doesn't happen.
I really hope that the memories that have been fostered, the love and the emotion for those trees, should be the legacy of the tree.
The BLM is taking public comment on Cottonwood W through the end of the month. Reporting from Sierra Vista, Michelle Marisco, KJZZ News.
It's Monday, so let's celebrate the working life. We're looking at the people who do the jobs you sometimes don't see or don't think about. With the launch of the mobile phone game Pokemon Go, you may be one of the thousands of people in the Valley searching the city for Pokemon, Pokestops, and gyms. And the game doesn't stop just because the sun goes down. Today, it's another late night on the job as a public safety aide.
My name is Donovan Haney. I'm the public safety aide supervisor for Graveyard Shift. We're at the Mesa Community College at Dobson and Southern. Our job is a lot of loss prevention and anti-trespassing. Up until the launch of Pokemon Go and the increased traffic on campus, I preferred to be on foot. I do take the golf cart almost every night now, every time I go out of the office. But before Pokemon Go, what we mostly found was, you know, the occasional drunks who would come across from the two bars across the road. Probably take about 20 minutes to go through the entire campus and search people out, and then we go through going back and double checking doors and making sure that the custodians are closing them behind them. Sometimes we have classes getting out late. Good evening.
Hello.
Campus is closed at this time.
Okay.
Yep, have a good night.
You too.
We've had several vehicles who have decided to drive through here because of the Pokestops. Bravo 569, I've secured the motor pool gate.
Yeah.
Some of the places where the Pokestops are very dimly lit, and we have a very minimal aid force to do patrols with, and so if somebody decided to use the waypoints to take advantage of people, we would have no way of patrolling frequently enough to find them every time. So we try and cut down on the number of loiterers just for that reason.
That's Donovan Haney patrolling Mesa Community College. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody.
When you think of a terrorist, who do you think of? That's the question Dr. Lori Poloni-Stauninger puts to her students at Northern Arizona University every year. She's a professor and the department chair of the Politics and International Affairs Department at NAU, and her work focuses on the intersection of women and terrorism. The show's Lauren Gilger had a chance to talk to her about her work and her upcoming book, Terrorism and Women, A Gender Analysis of Perpetrators, Responders, and the Public. And Lauren, does that mean she studies women who are terrorists?
Well, yes, she does look at women who are terrorists, but she also studies how women respond to terrorism and how women leaders address terrorism and how they are perceived. And when I sat down with her, I asked her if when we think about the war on terrorism, we think about it as a man's war.
I mean, you say the word terrorism, and I do this with students when I'm teaching it. I say, you know, write down what you think about when I say the word terrorist. And a picture of a woman, particularly a Western woman, does not come to mind. And it's often talked about in very masculine ways. It's talked about in a way that women do not have a place either as terrorists or as responders to terrorism.
Why is that?
We are socialized to think of women as life givers, not as life takers. So women have babies, they don't take away life, is sort of how we're socialized to think of women. And so when women act violently, it clashes with this sociological stereotype that we have about them. And that's why. That's why it doesn't come to mind. In the same sort of way for women who are responders to terrorists. So when we think about what it takes to make a good leader, the words that we use to make a good leader, words like strong, decisive, right, tough, those aren't words that we are socialized to associate with women. But those are the words that we want when we're talking about responding to terrorism. And so it clashes with what our socializations are about what it is to be feminine and what it is to be masculine.
Right. Are we wrong about that, though? Are there a significant number of women terrorists?
Yeah, we are wrong about that. We don't know the exact number of terrorists because you can't census them, right? You can't fill out the survey, are you a terrorist? But depending upon the group, there are, we believe, anywhere from 10 to 30, 40% of terrorists are women. So it's not uncommon to have women who are acting as terrorists.
Right. Well, and what comes to mind when I think about that is, so in San Bernardino and in Orlando, the wives of the men who committed those terrorist acts were both called into question. Is that typical or is that sort of an anomaly?
It's not necessarily an anomaly. Some people will argue that women become involved in terrorists for several different reasons. One of those reasons can be because of a relationship, that they're recruited into an organization through a male relative or a boyfriend or husband or something like that. And it's often this is played up, right? So in San Bernardino, you saw the woman talked about as the wife of the terrorist, right? Not as a terrorist herself. And often men are recruited into terrorist organizations through friends or relatives in the same sort of way, but that's not usually talked about in the same way that it is with women.
So when we look at women leaders who are reacting to terrorism or fighting against terrorism, are you looking at the possibility right now of having a female president and how that might change that dynamic?
Yeah, it could. And I think it'll be interesting to see the way in which particularly the media handles this. We did one study where we looked at that iconic White House photo of the Abbottabad raid that killed Osama bin Laden. And in that photo, Hillary Clinton has her hand over her mouth. There's a lot of people sitting around that table in the Situation Room. She was given the most emotion by the media when they were talking about the picture.
She was like the center of that
right.
photo.
Right. And talking about, like, you could see everything in her eyes, the emotionalism in her face, the anguish that was there. Sort of all of these sort of highly emotional words were associated with her. Mm-hmm. When it came out subsequently, the photographer said that he had clicked a whole bunch of pictures, right? He's like, click, 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 click in succession. And she happened to be sneezing. She had allergies or something. She happened to be sneezing in that particular picture, and her hand was over her mouth. It wasn't a gasp, but it was talked about for a week, multiple, 2 weeks later as this gasp.
You've been studying this for a long time,
right.
This sort of intersection of women in terrorism. Have things changed?
Things have changed in the sense that the group has changed. So right, it did move from Al-Qaeda, and now we're not talking about Al-Qaeda anymore. I also think it's changed a little bit our sensitivity to women as terrorists. We've become a little bit desensitized to it. It's not as shocking to us as a public anymore as it was when we saw the first spate of suicide women terrorists in the 2000s. It was very shocking to us then. Now it's becoming a little bit more normal.
What do you think that does for our perceptions of terrorism?
we still have gendered perceptions of terrorism. So we still talk in very gendered ways about women who are terrorists and about women who respond to terrorists. But I think if we can begin to see women terrorists not necessarily as a normal thing, so then not that terrorism's normal, but they are terrorists just like men who are terrorists, then our counterterrorism policies become more effective.
And that's the show's Lauren Gilger speaking with NAU professor Lori Poloni-Stauninger about her upcoming book on the intersection of women and terrorism.
The Ducey administration decided Arizona needed a catchphrase, some simple way to sell the state to the rest of the world, especially tourists or entrepreneurs who may consider moving here. The results of the commission study are in, and the state doesn't have a new slogan. The consultant who worked on the study says people are most positive about what she labeled the Arizona lifestyle. So I guess for now, we're sticking with Grand Canyon State. To talk more about the study, I'm joined by Kathy Heasley, the consultant who is in charge of it. She's founder of Heasley & Partners. Kathy, did you go into this project expecting to end up with some catchy slogan or easy reference point for Arizona?
We really weren't looking for a slogan per se. We were really looking for truth. We really wanted to see what Arizona was really about. What made this place a place that people choose to live?
How many different kinds of people, how many different people just in general did you speak to?
I spoke with and listened to countless leaders in the state, whether they be business leaders, you know, leaders in the art community, diversity groups, leaders from rural communities, from tribal communities, cities, entrepreneurs, technical and technology people. We also did a survey. It was about, I want to say, between 20 and 30 questions, all open-ended, 100% open-ended, where people could share whatever they wanted to say. We invited 500,000 people to participate, both all in Arizona and in several cities around the nation that, you know, people technically or typically come to Arizona from, like Boston and New York and Los Angeles, you know. So we got just tons and tons of data.
How important is it that Arizona itself does have something to hang its hat on so that people can peg it to something? Because if other communities that we're competing against have something, we need to have something too, right?
It is important for Arizona to be able to hang its hat on some aspect of what the state has. And for many years, really, we're known as, you know, the Grand Canyon State, and we do have that amazing, you know, wonder of the world, plus all the beauty, you know, between our southernmost border and our northernmost border. You know, it's just incredible the amount of beauty that we have here. And I think to a large degree, that is one of the very first stakes in the ground that we can really hold up and that still needs to be held up, you know, because it is true. And people do love that aspect about the state. In addition to that, the thing that we can really show and demonstrate is what it's like to be in that beautiful realm.
Do you think that the state has been missing out on an opportunity by not necessarily embracing this sort of lifestyle aspect of branding? And how much do you think that can help the state going forward if there's almost like a flexibility to it? There's this idea that it can be so many different things to so many different people.
The goal of it wasn't to get all those percentages of like, somewhat like, you know, very much like, all of that. There's been lots of studies that have, you know, given that kind of data about various aspects of the state. But what we were really looking for in this, you know, find the heart, hold the mirror up to the state process is we're looking for those real life stories that truly connect with people heart to heart.
Kathy Heasley of Heasley & Partners, she was in charge of the recent effort to come up with a new branding plan for Arizona. Branding generally is becoming more important for cities and states. And with me to expand on that is Marion Salzman of Havas PR. She's also a Forbes magazine contributor. Marion, how vital is specific branding for a place these days?
It is crucial that a city or a place, any place, because it can be a neighborhood, it can be a state, it can be a community, it can be a national park. It is imperative that a place is a story. It is an authentic story. It is not necessarily imperative that it have a master brand. And if by that I mean it doesn't necessarily need to have a visual, it doesn't necessarily need to have a slogan or a call to action, but it is imperative that it stands for something and it gets known for what it stands for.
as technology improves, as marketing can be really focused on smaller and smaller groups of people, can that be used when it comes to branding a place as well? Like, if you know someone has an interest in this, can you modify your brand to fit this particular sector?
In today's world, everything needs to be marketed to a universe of one, me, me, me. And whether the me is 19 years old and looking for a place to pursue an education, or 27 years old and looking for a place to launch a career, or 34 years old and looking for a place to take family on a vacation, I want it spoon-fed to me. So I'm a foodie, I'm an athlete, I'm an outdoors person, I'm interested in Southwestern art and photography. I don't care about what somebody else is interested in. I want my experience, my lifestyle, my brand. Then there's also the incremental of some of our best tourists, some of our best visitors to a place are near-cationers or staycationers, people who actually live there. You need to speak to them in a very different voice and with a very different sense of appropriateness than the person who's traveling 300 miles, let alone 3,000 miles.
Well, then how does that impact when a city or a state or a community decides to ask for public input? What are the pluses and minuses of that?
I believe that in today's world, public engagement is absolutely essential. One can't tell people what a place is about. One can ask people, how do you feel about this place? What is about this place is uniquely for you? The real problem is when you serve it back up, it becomes incredibly hard to come up with a generality. And I think it's why so many states and place brands have come under such scrutiny, unless it's an organic pop-up along the lines of keep Austin weird. And there are some people in Austin who would really love to reject that, but yet the weirdness of Austin is what makes it kind of unique. But that's sort of a natural, authentic, not necessarily a top-down branding strategy, but rather bottom-up.
The governor's administration commissioned a study to decide, you know, what should there be? In many ways, I think they were thinking of, in terms of a catchphrase or something like that. A lot of people were disappointed that there wasn't something that came out in a simple fashion. What would you say to people who are just sort of disappointed that you can't simplify it to a slogan?
I would actually be very proud of the state for recognizing that there may be too many conflicting visuals, conflicting sentiments, let's even assume all positive, and to dictate any one would be put yourself out for scrutiny on why did you leave out. So if we just talk about the physical terrain, why are we not talking about the arts? If we just speak about the old rancher culture, why are we not speaking about Arizona's multiculturalism?
Marion Saltzman is the CEO of Habas PR and a Forbes magazine contributor. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5. On this first day of the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, conflict has unofficially been on the agenda. We'll have the latest on the RNC at 3 on All Things Considered. Then stay with us for special coverage tonight at 6 on KJZZ. When you think of movies about musicians, nothing is as classic as Purple Rain. Now reimagine that story in the Saharan Desert. That's exactly what Portland-based director Christopher Kirkley did with his film.
Akunak Tadalet Taha Tazri.
That's the title of the movie in the language Tamashek, spoken by the Tuareg ethnic group in North and West Africa. It literally translates to rain the color of blue with a little red in it, since there's no word in Tamashek for purple. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry spoke with Christopher Kirkley, whose film will be showing in Tucson on Wednesday night.
The movie features a famous Tuareg guitarist. He's from the West African country of Niger, and his name is Mdou Mokhtar. This is the first fiction feature in Tamashek. Let's hear a little bit from the trailer so that you can hear what the language sounds like. Right now, there's this amazing wave of guitarists from the region playing this incredibly unique style of music that's often described as desert rock or desert blues. You heard a little bit just now. I asked Christopher Kirkley to explain what characterizes this music.
It's guitar-based. It's often electric guitar. It's pentatonic. It has sort of this blues edge to it, but it's loud. I mean, they play with a full drum set, play through really loud amplifiers, cranked up all the way into this gritty distortion. It's basically like the energetic rock folk music of the Sahara.
How How did you come to this idea, taking essentially ideas from the movie Purple Rain and then applying them to Tuareg guitarists?
I wanted to make something that wasn't a documentary. I felt like there's been so many documentaries about Tuareg guitar, and I wanted to do something with a fictional format. And so naturally, I kind of jumped to Purple Rain as the quintessential fictional rock movie. Typical story of this musician trying to make it against all odds. And so I thought, well, that's something that could work in the Sahara. So I took that idea, I took the film, and I called Imdu Mokhtar, who's one of the musicians who I'd already been working with for some time. And I said, hey, do you want to make a remake of this 1980s Western rock movie?
And he was just down.
Yeah, I mean, he was into working on pretty much whatever. Part of what worked for Purple Rain, for Prince, you know, Purple Rain did a lot for Prince's career. And I was hoping that we could maybe do the same thing with Imdu, you know, because I wanted to make this film and I wanted to have Imdu want to make this film too. And so part of his idea of being involved with it was I get to be a star in the first ever Tuareg language rock movie. And maybe that will help me become a star like Prince.
Was there a reason that you chose him over all of the other Tuareg guitarists?
Yeah, I mean, Imdu, his character already lends itself to this like fictional portrayal. His personality is very agrarious and flamboyant. He's a very, very good musician who plays energetic Tuareg rock music. Unlike a lot of the other musicians in Niger, when he plays, he's jumping around on stage, he's doing these wild guitar solos. And so I wanted also a really good musician, because if you're gonna remake Purple Rain, you can't just choose any musician.
How much of the writing process was done collaboratively between you and Imdu?
When we made the film, I took this idea and I called Imdu and I talked to a French cinematographer, and over about 3 weeks, we watched Purple Rain, we talked about Purple Rain, we talked about Imdu's life and elements of his own story, but also of friends of his, and created this really like rough story of what would happen to this guitarist, this character in the film. There were a lot of other people who just would come through in the evening while we were drinking tea. So a lot of friends of Imdu and neighbors and would jump in and say, no, you should change this and make it this way. And then I took this story and adapted a proper script from that. When I traveled back to Niger to shoot, about 4 months later, the script was kind of thrown out the window at times because the actors would improvise. The actors were all speaking a language that I didn't even understand. So I didn't even know if they were actually saying the lines that were written. A lot of times they weren't, and we didn't find out until post. And they also adapted. They said, you know, this scene isn't written correctly. This wouldn't happen. We wouldn't do this in Agadez. And so they changed things to make it more accurate or reflective of how they wanted to be portrayed.
This movie takes place in the middle of the desert, and a lot of times the style of music that's represented in the movie is described as desert rock or desert blues. How important or influential is the desert to, I guess, to your film, but also more broadly sort of to the style of music that we're hearing?
Well, I think that this Tuareg music, when we talk about the Tuareg guitar, there's an element to it called Asuf. And Asuf can mean a lot of different things, but it means the desert, or it can mean loneliness. It can mean an empty place. Asuf is a more apt term than desert blues. And so I think there's a certain loneliness and a nostalgia that you hear in this music. It's got a haunting sound. It has a lot of space between the notes. And the origin of the music really is intrinsically tied to the desert.
Christopher Kirkley is the director of the film called Akunak for short, and he told me that his next film project in Niger is one that one of the actors in this film said he and his friends wanted to remake, Titanic. And instead of using a ship, they'll use a truck that will be taking immigrants to Libya. So stay tuned for Titanic in the Desert, which is the working title.
KJZZ's Sarah Ventry. Sarah, thanks.
Thank you.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.